turn.
Okay, May 1st, 2011, Parshas Kedoshim.
May Day.
Yeah,
you weren't wearing red.
The Torah portion this week, Parshas Kedoshim, is, as I said yesterday, is basically a parsha for ADD people. Right? Because basically the parsha is absolutely all over the place. Right? Every pasuk changes topics, and even intra the pasuk, even inside of one pasuk, you could have two or three mitzvos in one parsha, in one pasuk. Even more than that, right? You will see that there is no thematic system of division. Meaning, in this parsha, you find chukim, which means the laws that are above our logic, where God did not give the reason, such as meat and milk, such as the mixing of wool and linen, right side by side and interspersed with what we would call mishpatim, which are general statutes, which we would perhaps understand, or we understand the logic behind them, such as running government, or such as integrity in business, not stealing, not murdering, right? And then you have edus, you have testimonial mitzvahs, you have everything is all over the place here, right? So one has to ask, why is it like this? Why isn't it, you know, normally, you know, you organize things. Let's talk about the chukim, let's talk about the mishpatim, let's put it all organized. And here it's interesting because who is this given over to? Well, the more disorganized you are, and I use that word with respect, but the more disorganized you are, the more scholarly your audience needs to be, right? If you're all over the place, you had better make sure you have a very bright audience because otherwise they're going to get lost very quickly. But who do we find that God is speaking to here? Daber el kol, speak to all, adas the congregation, v'nei Yisrael of the children of Israel. This is not the regular assembly. Moses at times gave over the message to just the scholars, just the zekanim, the elders, the scholars. Sometimes he spoke to the men folk. Here, no, this is one for everybody, man, women, a child. Everybody was at this address that Moses gave. And here specifically, Moshe is all over the place. You know, it's interesting, you talk about organization and thought and presentation. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky was known as one of the great rabbis, I cite him often, one of the great rabbis in America from the 60s to the 80s, 50s to the 80s. And he was a master Rosh Hashiva, he was one of the head deans of the schools, and just an incredible personality. But often people complained, right, just say how great he was. When they brought him to Torah Vadas, to be the Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vadas, Torah Vadas had had a number of successive Rosh Yeshiva. When they brought him to Torah Vadas, the introduction that they gave at his intro, at his, you know, invitation, was that we're now bringing a Rosh Yeshiva that no one will ever outgrow. Meaning is that he's light years ahead and above everything and that's out there. He's not taking for himself, you understand. He's taking for others.
Well, to take the whole thing. That's what I'm saying.
He wants to be sure. The amount.
Right, very good. Ciao, very good. You're quick. So when Rabbi Yaakov would give the shir, the lecture in the yeshiva, the students complained among themselves that it's not scholarly enough. You know, they want something that, you know, back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. But they kept to themselves. One day, Rabbi Yaakov walks into class, into the lecture hall, and he says that, he says the lecture, and it is the most complicated, complex lecture, and the boys are sucking, drinking, lapping it up, lapping it up, lapping it up. At the end of the lecture, Rabbi Yaakov apologizes. And he says as follows, he says, I'm sorry that it was not as worked out as usual, but I was officiated at 3 weddings, 2 bar mitzvahs, a bris, a funeral, right? And therefore I didn't present it as I usually do. So the boys realized, and this is what Yaakov's genius was. Yaakov was so big and so great that he had worked out all of the things that when he presented, he always presented it smooth, like it had been smoothed over already, right? But over here, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't smooth it over. He didn't work it out. So I saw a very interesting point, and it's a point that we all have to take very seriously in its message. Is God specifically gave it to us in a very disorganized fashion at this point to the entire congregation because he did not want us to be top-heavy or to side with one style of mitzvah over another mitzvah. Judaism equates all 613 mitzvos are interspersed in our limbs of the body, right? They're all one, right? We don't say, you know, well, that mitzvah I keep, that mitzvah I don't keep. That one, that's not mine, right? Or, you know, I'm only into interpersonal relationships. The God one is not so much for me. Or, you know, I'm very, very pious and religious, you know, but I could cheat in business. Right? It's not so important. What the Torah is saying is that they're all interspersed. They're all part of the same garment. That they're all one. They cannot be, you know, if you pull out all clothing, right, is made up of strings. But if you just take string, it's worthless. It only works when the garment becomes one, right? When each thread is sewn in as part of the general whole, right? And that's what Hashem is showing us over here, right? The chukim and the mishpatim are one system. They're all meant to be connected and interspersed to create this beautiful fabric that we call Judaism, that we call the Torah. So that was a beautiful thought that I saw in preparing. Let's talk about the word kiddusha. Let's talk about the word sanctity for a minute. Right? What does the word sanctity mean? Right? When we talk about living a sanctified life, what does the word sanctified mean? Right? So what would you say?
Well, if you look at the root, the three-letter root, yes. It means to be dedicated to something. Dedicated for something. Mm-hmm. Like if you dedicate this poem to a person. It's like you're set apart and dedicated, you're identified as being dedicated for the honor or the glory of something right. else.
So one explanation that Vivian just cited is exclusive to, right? Dedicated to, I'll use the word exclusive to, and that is the explanation of marriage. What is marriage called? There are two parts to the marriage ceremony, but one part of it is called kiddushin, right? One idea behind that kiddushin, what you're saying is, right? Hare at, when the man gives the woman the ring, what are the words that he says? Hare at, behold, you are mikudeshet li, right? Sanctified unto me. That's how they translate it. But what does that mean? Sanctified unto me. Kidat Moshe v'Yisrael, according to the laws of Moses and Israel. Right? The most beautiful moment. What does it mean? Right? What it means is you are reserved, dedicated, right? But it means exclusive to. Meaning once a person enters the covenant of marriage, they cannot enter another covenant of marriage. You can only be married to one person, at least a woman can. Only be married... from biblical terms, can only be married to one person at a time, right? Let's say, well, right, you can't, it won't work. The kedushin eino tofsin. The kedushin does not take hold, right? So therefore, let's say another man gives her a ring, it wouldn't take hold. The marriage covenant would not take hold. Whereas, right, let's say a woman is forbidden to marry another person, right? I'm sorry. Let's say a woman is forbidden to marry a certain man in other areas. For example, a Kohen is not allowed to marry a divorcee. A Kohen is not allowed to marry a divorcee. Let's say a Kohen marries a divorcee. Does the Kedushin work or not work?
No.
So the answer is, it does work. Sorry.
It does?
It does. Meaning, she would then need a divorce from him. It could be that he has to give her a divorce, meaning they can give him a patch. Okay, he's going to get a patch, and he did a sin. right? But the kiddushin takes hold, whereas a woman who's already married would not take hold, right? What's the difference, right? It's this idea, because if a person is exclusive, right, you cannot hold two numbers. For example, it's like social security numbers. You can only get one social security number. Right, it only works. Right, one social security number per person. Right, normally.
Supposedly.
Right. You know, somebody was share with you a joke. I think this is. I have to say it in the name of Phil. You could tell Phil, please, that he was quoted at my Shabbos day. Somebody told it over to me from Phil. I don't remember who told him of me, but I'm pretty sure that it came from Phil. That basically a person gets called up from an aliyah. No, Phil told it. I'm sorry, somebody told it to me, then Phil told it to me too. That somebody, the gabbai of the synagogue goes over to the person and he asks him, what's your name? So he says, my name is Sarah Bas Moshe. So he says, no. What is your name? I told you, Sarah Bas Moshe. He says, your name can't be Sarah Bas Moshe. He says, listen, I declared bankruptcy, right, last year, and now I run all of my money through my wife. So when you get called to the aliyah for the donation, it's got to be through my wife. Right, it's leaving the joke aside, but you can only have one person, one name per person, one social security number. So you can only have one husband per person, otherwise it doesn't work. That's one definition. We are dedicated to God. That's one concept of Kiddushim to you. We have dedication. We're exclusive to God. Right? Elijah, right? Interesting. Elijah, if you know the story with Elijah on Mount Carmel, one of the most beautiful moments in the prophetic stories, right? There, the Jewish people were battling. They were
wavering.
Thank you. They were wavering between God and a idol called Baal, which was a very popular idol for centuries of that time. Okay, it was a very, very popular idolatry of the time. Right? So Elijah, at the moment, made what we would call a Sinai 2 experiment. He basically gathered the tribes. This was in the 10 tribes. He gathered the tribes around, and he was going to show once and for all, again, that God is God. And what happens? He got the idols, 450 of the prophets of Baal, or the priests of Baal, and he, Elijah, on the other side. They each were going to bring a ox, and whoever brings the fire down from heaven is the winner. Right? Very easy, very simple. Elijah deferred to the idolatrous priests that they can go first. The idolatrous priests, they prepared their altar, but they also hedged their bet. What did they do? They had prepared for this in advance, and like our Palestinian counterparts, they dug tunnels. And what they did is they dug a tunnel, and a man snuck through the tunnel, and he stood underneath the altar that they had built in order to light the match at the when he was given the signal. Okay, they were going first at midday, right? Or actually, they were a little bit before midday, and they slaughtered the bull, and they put it on top of the altar. They then began singing and dancing and chanting. Now, the purpose of that chanting was to signal to their friend underneath that it was time to light the match. And obviously it did not burn, so therefore they sang louder. And then it's described that they began cutting themselves, which was popular to bloodlet, which is where you would cut yourself in honor of the idol. That was part of the whole system. And lo and behold, nothing happened, because God had caused that a snake should knock off the guy that was underneath the altar in order to see that he does not light the fire. And they were given as much time as they wanted, and unfortunately they knew something went wrong, but there was little that they could do. Okay. Then it was Elijah's turn. So Elijah, what he did is he built the altar. He then took the ox, he slaughtered it, put it up, and then he began pouring buckets and buckets and buckets of water. And he built a trough around it to give the impression that the whole altar is in water, which means that wood obviously cannot burn if it's wet. Okay. Then Elijah prayed, and a fire came down from heaven and burnt not only the bull, but burnt the wood, and not only the wood, but the altar, not only the altar, but the trough. The whole thing went boom. So Elijah ruined it. Before he did this, called down the fire, he told the Jewish people in his public address, he said, if you are for Baal, you're for Baal. If you're Baal, go serve Baal. If you're for God, serve God. That was his introduction, Right? Then he did this miracle, and everybody fell on the floor and said, Hashem hu Elokim, Hashem hu Elokim, the Lord is God, the Lord is God. Okay, that was the story. So, everybody asks, how could Elijah say the words, if you are for Baal, be for Baal, if you are for God, be for God? How could you utter such words? Right? So Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, in an incredible essay, explains it very simply and so truthfully. He says that what Elijah was saying is that you cannot, an ono ata poseach al shtei ha-si'ifim, until when will you waver on the fence? You gotta be for one thing. Why? Because when you're for one thing, if you make a mistake, you go somewhere else. If you're wavering, you're like a teeter. A little here, a little there. You keep bouncing back and forth. You're never in one place. So you never make a mistake because we lean a little this way, you lean a little this way. No, you got to pick something and go for it. And then you're wrong? Okay, you're wrong. You'll try another plan. But as long as you're trying to ride the fence, you're not going to commit to anything, then there's nothing. Then you're committed to nothing. Right. And that's why Elijah told them, right, just as a close to the story, right, that was one lesson of the story. And that's what Kiddushin means, dedicate yourself. You got to find yourself firmly committed in Judaic principles, firmly committed to God, firmly committed to Torah. That's one explanation of Kiddushin to you. Just to conclude the story there, Izebel, who was the queen of the time, who was the anti-Elijah force, she was an idolatress. Elijah, after they finished, he destroyed the Baal, the priests of Baal. They were knocked out. Okay? Knocked out figuratively and literally. Izebel told Elijah, right, a very interesting message she sent him. Elijah, tomorrow I will kill you. That was what she sent him, a message. So I don't understand. What does that mean? Tomorrow I will kill you. If you want to kill him, you kill him today. You don't tell somebody, tomorrow I'm going to kill you. You don't write somebody a message, tomorrow I'm going to kill you. What did she mean? So Chaim Shmulevitz says, right, that Elijah, inspiration is short-lived if it is not concretized in action. Elijah, you impressed the people. Today, if I killed you, they would lynch me. Tomorrow, they won't remember your name. Figuratively. Right? True. Which is the essence. Inspiration is like a match. Right? We all go to lectures, we're inspired. Right? Right? But what happens to a match? After 30 seconds, it's out. If it doesn't take hold in something, if it doesn't kindle something, take hold, doesn't have a new fuel source, nothing, it'll go out. That's what inspiration is. Inspiration, you need the match. Without inspiration, you get nowhere because you got no fire. You have nothing to combust, right? But you need to light something. It needs to take hold. We talked about blessings and after blessings. There's a great story in the Yeshiva Volozhin. Yeshiva Volozhin was the Harvard of the day. That was the central yeshiva. It was the first yeshiva, and it was the yeshiva of all yeshivos. Right? You had to be a genius just to get in. They were in the dining room, right, discussing, right, a Talmudic page. Right, the boys were discussing a Talmudic page, and they were discussing a Tosfos, which is one of the commentaries, the glosses to the Talmud. So they were arguing. So one of the boys was a very diligent student, was arguing, no, that there's no Tosfos there that says such. They're arguing, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. Finally, somebody grabbed a volume, opened it up, and showed him he was wrong. This was in the middle of the meal. So the boy ran out. He was so upset. He ran out of the dining room and ran back to the Beis Medrash and wouldn't leave till he had reviewed the entire tractate. Right? He literally slept. He wasn't going to leave. That's a famous story in Volozhin that they say over the dedication. So somebody asked the stipler, when he said over this story, he says, Rebbe, I don't understand. The boy didn't bench. He didn't say grace after meals. How could he leave the dining room? He didn't say grace after meals. So the stipler told him, you're right. He was wrong for leaving the dining room. But if he wouldn't have left the dining room at that moment and ran to the Beis Medrash, it never would have worked. Inspiration is fantastic, but if you don't do something about it right away, it fizzles away. It's just human nature of the way it is. If you don't concretize something, it goes up in the air. One of the most beautiful lessons, right? That's what we learn from the queen of evil, of Izebel. Right? Tomorrow, right, in her genius of human psychology, tomorrow I'll kill you. Today you're a big shot. Tomorrow they won't remember your name. It's a beautiful, beautiful lesson with many, many lessons to learn.
Did she tell him?
She chased him, but Elijah was always one step ahead. I mean, God, which is not a guarantee of a prophet, by the way. There is no guarantee that a prophet will not be killed, but that's not our class today. There is no guarantee, but Elijah was never killed. Elijah was never killed.
Rabbi, what happens if there's inspiration and it takes hold? You said you have to do something.
Right.
You have to do something.
Right.
But there's that wavering between the idolatry and the kedushim of...
Right. So that's human challenge. There the key often is to have... there's a number of issues that you need to. One is the pen is important to set down where the goals are. Right? The second is a teacher is necessary. Right? A mentor is necessary. Or even a chavrusa, right? Even a partner is necessary. And the whole AA is built upon having a sponsor. Thank you. That's right. A sponsor, right? That's one of the ideas that we need. A man to his friend should strengthen one another, right? Interestingly enough, that's a very popular ish es chaveiro yomer chazak is a very popular quote from prophets, from the books of the prophets. Right, it actually became a popular song, a Hebrew song a few years ago. Right, very, very popular, number one hit Hebrew song, right, in the yeshiva world. What was interesting is that if you look at it in context, it's a haftorah. If you look at it in context in the prophets, it was talking about idolatry. It was saying each worshiper would give strength to his other in order to strengthen the whole nonsense of idolatry. I'm not saying you can't quote a book. Now, somebody printed this, that how could they sing a song about that? It's really not a good thing, because it is the style of Judaic greats to use verses out of context, not to quote out of context, but to use the words out of context to say a concept. So it wasn't such a question. You do see that. In general, it's not what you quote out of context. I don't mean that, like you quote a speaker out of context, but you quote concepts from the Bible, even necessarily, and use them as word plays. But that's the idea. But that's the way it is, right? Whether it be for good or for bad, right? The peers that you find yourself in, right, is what's going to strengthen you. In Covey's book, right, Covey is seven. How does it go?
Seven habits.
Seven habits of highly effective people. Now, I will recommend, by the way, it'll sound a little bit infantile, but if you ever want to read the book, I recommend. The son wrote the book, took the father's book, and wrote it for teenagers. I would sooner recommend the book for teenagers than I would Covey's original. It is much more, not watered down, it's more readable. Covey's, I found, was a little bit, very, very high, a little bit more difficult to read. The teenager's one reads. It just reads, right? It's the same principles, right? And I think that you'll get the same thing out of it. Okay, some of it a little bit, maybe a little bit, the examples might be a little bit out of context to yourself. But I did find it very, very good. I certainly would recommend it to any older teenager to read. But I think that even for adults, it's a book well worth reading. But we know that that's my, if you're wondering, that's my restroom literature. So that's
what
it's
very.
Covey's Seven Habits of Highly Effective Teens. Right. Seven Habits of Highly Effective Teens. A beautiful book. It's the same as his adult book, just it's the examples is a little bit more contextual to teens, but the English language by which it's written is a much simpler language, right? Rabbi Wein, I was speaking about this yesterday, Rabbi Wein used to tell us, when you're speaking in public, use words that you normally use. He did not believe in using sophisticated language in speaking, even though he himself was highly, highly literate, right, Rabbi Wein. But he didn't feel that it was proper to speak either in language that you don't normally use. He said two rules. Either language that you don't normally use or language that your audience doesn't normally use. Don't try to, what he used to say, don't try to impress people with language. Language is a communication skill, right? It's meant to communicate the idea. And you should speak at the level of your audience. Okay, well, drop above, but not speak in five syllable words when your audience is not of that level. That's what he used to tell us. Okay, the reason I mention that is because there he speaks about, right, what we know from Pirkei Avos. I mean, basically, the book is basically Pirkei Avos, Ethics of Our Fathers. That basically is that the idea of taking, of having peers, where you find yourself is where you'll be, right? And also setting up shomrim, right? Setting up partners. For example, they have this new web thing on the web now called web watchers. We'll talk about that actually in our second definition of Kedoshim Tiyu. Right, called web watcher or web chaver. Web chaver means a web friend. So they designed this site that basically all of the serfs that you go to on the internet will be viewed by your partner. So, for example, people put my name down on, they register this, and then their computer is connected with this filter. It's not a filter. The one is a filter. There's two different things out there. This is not a filter at all. You can go to any site you want. Right, but your sponsor is going to get a report of which sites you go to. So, for example, I get every week or two. I don't remember how many days I get it, but it tells me all the sites the person went to. Right, so I can see right away where they went to. Right, so that's the idea of setting up. So, what's your menace? Because you know nobody wants that somebody else. You know, as long as you feel alone, right, you can get away with something. Right? Or human nature is we delude ourselves, despite that we know it's damaging, right? Right. But when you know somebody's watching, right, there's a greater care. Right. It's interesting. What did Rabbi Yochanan say on his deathbed? Right. This is Rabbi Yochanan, the greatest rabbi of the time. He was on his deathbed. This is a rabbi of the Mishnah. Right. It's going back 2,000 years. His students said to him on his deathbed, asked him, Rabbi Barchenu, bless us. What did he say? Right, he said, may your fear of God be like your fear of man. Right? So they asked him, Rebbe, that's all? Our fear of God should be just like the fear of man? The fear of God shouldn't be more? So what did he answer him? Halavai, would it be that your fear of God would be like the fear of man? And this is 2,000 years ago, and who was he speaking to? He wasn't speaking to people on the street like you and I. He was students, were the greatest students that were going to inherit the leadership of the Jewish people. Right? You're talking about the cream de la creme. but he was telling the reality. The reality is, it is human nature. It's a given. It's human nature that we have a certain amount of fear that people shouldn't find out what we're doing. Right? It's human nature. Use human nature to your advantage. That's what he's trying to give over the message. Use human nature to your advantage. It's human nature. And therefore, you set up systems by which other people could view what you're doing. All right, then we'll elaborate more on this in a moment when we get to the second definition of kiddushin.
Isn't that saying backwards, may your fear of man be like your fear of God?
May your fear of
What
did I say?
Fear of God be like your fear of man, you said.
Yes. Meaning your relation.
No, we don't have a fear of man. We want the fear of man to be like our fear of God.
I apologize. I'm sorry. Fear of man, I didn't explain it properly. What I meant to say is like this. What I meant to say is the fear of man means that if I'm looking at a negative website, I'm going to be embarrassed if you see that.
I got the mess right.
Okay. Yeah. Meaning, so he's saying is that always think of God as walking in the room a second later.
Right. So may your fear of man be like your fear of God. Yeah, not people may your fear of God be like your fear of man.
No, because
most people have no fear of God. Because God isn't real to them.
Hurt checking on you.
I'm the reverse. Okay, see, there you go. Because I have the fear of God, and they go, he's watching. Mm-hmm. Whereas with man, okay, all right.
You are so holy. You're so holy that you're above common people.
But I'm saying we don't have fear of man in general. We don't. Look what people do all the time.
That's a problem. We're going to get to that's a problem. That's a problem that we're going to get to when we discuss society. You're correct. We'll get to that problem. That's an issue itself is a discussion that we're going to have to discuss now. That's my second. Okay. I apologize.
Yeah, about this business, about the web deal, all right? When I was first learning, all right, I belonged to a program called Partners in Torah. All right? You get a chaver on the phone, and he talks to you once a week, and you learn with him for free.
Right. In fact, I just heard an incredible story. There was a Jew in Colombia. He somehow ended up in Colombia, and somehow somebody was doing business with him and inspired him that he's got to get closer to his roots. He, by coincidence, married a Jewish girl. Not by choice, just what happened. So he got inspired. The guy that inspired him was leaving. So he says, here, I'm telling you, there's this organization called Partners in Torah that I know will arrange with you to learn with somebody on the phone once a week. Right, and that's what he left him the number. So the guy called. So just last night I was reading, the guy called, and now years later, through that, is studying once a week, and what he called, and then he had arranged, well, did you ever get married to this Jewish girl? He says, no, we never got married. We never got Jewish. We never had a Jewish marriage. We just got married in Colombia. So they arranged, so they spoke about, okay, you got to go visit Israel, and they arranged for him to visit Israel, and he visited what he called, and he got married. A whole beautiful story, just from this one, from this encounter several years ago, somebody handing him a telephone number.
Mm-hmm. See, my chavrusa, many, many years ago, I found out his brother was my Rabbi Rausch's chavrusa in school. So, you know, it's just coincidental. It's great. So if y'all want the number, I have it here.
Okay. Next, kiddushim to you, a second explanation. Rashi says that kiddushim comes from heve pirushim min ha'arayis u'min aveira, to separate yourself from illicit relationships, from immorality and sin. Everything connected with immorality, because God abhors immorality. Right, it's something that God cannot tolerate. It is the opposite. Immorality is the antithesis of spirituality. The two cannot dwell side by side. Right, so says Rashi, kedoshim to you is connected with that which the Torah spoke about right before, and actually closes the parasha with immorality. If you want to leading a sanctified life, means separating yourself from immorality. That is Rashi's definition for sanctity. That, right, is the secret of sanctity. It is not, right? It is not abhorring sexuality, right? It's not, we are not priests, right? We are not trying to do away with it, nor are we trying to say that it's dirty. But it has to be reserved for a sanctified relationship, right? The great challenge of society at large is that they have, in all areas, driven themselves away from this concept, both in the ability to separate intimacy from the relationship itself, right? Which is, there was a movie out, which is probably the worst movie of the year. I didn't know because I did not see it, but they had the billboard, so my wife told me what it said. I could tell the billboard was negative, so I couldn't read the billboard, but I asked her why I knew that it had something in it that I, so she told me. I forgot the name of the movie, but it said is you can separate love from intimacy or sexuality. I forgot the name.
Oh, I know what it was. It was this couple made a bet. That they could
I didn't know anything. I just know the billboard. Oh, and not fall in love.
Right.
Oh, that's what it's about. Okay. So I didn't know. I didn't know the details. I just know the billboard. She had read me the line, what it says. You see, when I travel on planes, I shouldn't tell you my secrets. But the way that I know about most movies is when I travel on the plane. You know, they have in the back of the seat. They tell you all the movies that they show, right? So I read all of the movies. So I, because you know, they give you a 10-second blurb, you know, a one-paragraph blurb on each movie. So this is how I find out what all the movies that are out, right? But this idea of can you separate in Judaism, the two are intimately, pardon the pun, but they're connected one with the other. But we have, so yeah, on the one hand, you have that separation. On the other hand, you also have, right, all, you're bombarded with the billboards in general of that you could do what you want, you could see what you want, you could say what you want, right? Many of the billboards throughout LA are all telling you that if you go to this and this place, you could see whatever you want to see, and it's permitted, right? Why is it permitted? Right, that we talked about the other day, because everybody does it. There's a heter called everybody does it. Heter means there's a permission slip, everybody does it. So everybody can't be wrong. Everybody can't be wrong, right? So if there's three billboards on one corner, in one corner that I have to turn on, unfortunately, on one corner there are three billboards with the same that you can visit three different places, right? The problem is that if there's three billboards, there's very little place for me to look, right? If I still have to, no matter which angle you pick, you're going to get bombarded, right? Right, but it's a big problem. It's a big problem. But what is the message that it's giving over to you, the bombardment, is the message that it gives you is that it's okay. It's okay. Right? At least if it was reserved only in the red district, what they used to call the red district. Mm-hmm. It's one thing. So if you wanted, you went there, beside there. Okay, you knew it existed. But when you see the billboards all over, what it's screaming to you is everybody is doing it. Once you have everybody doing it, it's a problem. It's screaming to you that you don't need to live a life of sanctity. Judaism is living a life of sanctity. What does sanctity mean? It doesn't mean piety. No. It means one simple thing, says Rashi. It means stay away from immorality. That's it. If you stay away from immorality, you are by force living a life of sanctity. But unfortunately, we live in a society that's screaming and inviting in a fashion unheralded before in history, this issue, right? It used to be in our days.
Except for the Roman period.
When I was a kid, right, what was the, in order to get a negative magazine, the only way that you could see anything was in magazines, right? You had to sneak into the bookstore, and this was a bookstore that sold it, and you had to sneak in, and you had to make sure nobody was watching, because you would get caught. It was put away, right? Today, nothing doing. You have the internet, right? Sad to say, right? The majority and the vast majority of traffic on the internet is for negative things, right? Right? Now, of course, God created the internet for us to have the ability to learn Torah. That's the purpose of its creation, right? Right? It is unbelievable what is there, and it's unbelievable what will be there in the coming month, even in the coming months. Because they're sending me links, because a lot of these organizations, right, or I found donors that are willing to publish. For example, they're just launching a website now, Siddur Live. The entire service read on the internet. Read on it, sung on the internet. Everything that you could want from a Siddur to learn how to daven is going to go live. It's called Siddur Live. Then I got another one that within the year they're going to launch the website, and we had talked about this before, about how to lane the Torah. So somebody is putting up on the web in a much more sophisticated fashion than has been till now, any of these programs till now, how to learn how to read the Torah, how to this Torah, blah, 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 and everything is going to be totally on the internet with the pages, with the matching songs, with everything clickable.
Wow.
Right. Wow. That's the internet.
We have a banana gun.
Quick question. Does that mean that your level of Kedusha, when you see a billboard and you catch a glimpse, your level, when you catch, right. you turn away? Like, my brother, but I don't
the
really
Avera,
ask him.
Okay, let me tell you. I was once walking. You were there when I spoke on the thing. So I apologize for repeating it. But I was once walking in Israel on Friday night. No, we'll start with a different story. This you didn't hear. Start with a different story. There was a young man in the yeshiva in England. Not Manchester. One of the yeshivas in England, Rav Dessler was the mashgiach, was the dean of students. And he wanted to go, he, in order to go to a wedding, to leave the yeshiva, you had to get permission from the mashgiach. So he went to get the permission from the mashgiach. So the mashgiach asked him, this was in a story in the 40s, I believe. So he asked him, who's going to be at the wedding? He says, well, there'll be people not properly dressed. Right? Today the yeshiva wouldn't bother asking, because every wedding has people not properly dressed. But there was a time when people came properly dressed. So he says, there'll be people not... But the boy said like this, he was 17, 18. He says, there'll be people not properly dressed, but it doesn't affect me. So, we have Dessler. Okay, so he reaches down into his desk, and he hands the boy a card, like a business card. Right, and the boy leaves. The boy leaves. So the boy gets out of the room, so he looks at the card, right? And he sees it's the number to a psychologist. So he didn't understand. He thought it was like a number to a taxi. I don't know what the boy thought. And exactly, didn't say this is what he thought when he was leaving the room. But so he didn't understand. So of course, he knocks on the door. Yes? So he comes back in and he says, Mashgiach, I'm sorry for troubling the Mashgiach, but I think you must have given me the wrong card. He says, listen, I'm 80 years old, I'm blind in one eye, and I limp, and I'm still affected when I see ladies that are improperly dressed. He says, if you're 18 and you're not affected, obviously it's psychology. That's it. So any person that thinks either they're ill, right, which unfortunately I dealt with that too, but ill, or they're a liar. So the first thing is, they're a liar. Right? I was once walking in Israel.
Or they're ignorant. That boy didn't know how much it
affected. Oh, he knew.
He was young.
He knew. Of course he knew.
Okay.
He knew.
I want to say something about that. I think that a lot of this is a cultural artifact. What is improperly dressed? What affects you? I mean, there are many cultures in warm climates, right, where the women are, right, very not dressed. And I'm not saying that looking at a woman does not affect a man. I think that's probably universal. Mm-hmm. But what's considered risque, right, and what's considered improper or improper, you could be very covered up,
right,
and still affect a man very nicely. So, you know, you can technically,
yes,
completely meet the spec. In fact, you can meet it and not even be skin tight and whatever, but if you're a beautiful woman with a nice shape that still shows, you know, unless you put a burqa on a woman.
Mm. You even are, then, they wouldn't look at the
I just want to make this point as an anthropologist. I think that it's a cultural artifact. What affects a man and what doesn't?
Correct. You're correct.
And I think part of the problem is that we make this big boogeyman out of the improper, and then very little will affect a man.
I don't find it to be a boogeyman. Even in my training, I mean, when a man and woman are in the room, there's an unspoken sexuality. It's a man and a woman. So if you start with that as your baseline, albeit cultural specificity about dress or, you know, revealing parts of the body, but fully clothed, there's a sexuality. So, you know, I think exercising caution and not advertising that this is my identity. You know, I need to walk around with
my point is that I think that there are two planes. I agree that that we should work for modesty. But I think that only, like, handing the psychologist thing to this young man, I'm sure he was affected to some extent, but there is an attitude that we develop of not being affected, of saying, I'm a modest person and I'm not going to be looking around to see who the good-looking people are of the opposite sex and allow myself to get, I think that, to get affected. I think that there's two ways to look at it. It's not just a technical thing, I think it's a mental thing as well. Okay. And I think that because it's a cultural artifact, we can also individually...
Okay, so we're going to get to the second part. So you're asking, there are two different issues. You're raising three different points. Regarding... Let's go to the second story. You're saying that a person has to be careful, what we call shmir seinaim. He has to watch what he's looking at.
I think he also needs to watch his perception, his interpretation of what he's looking at. I think that there's a mindset, a filter that we have, mm-hmm. that we get it from society. You just talked about how we get this filter that a lot of things are okay and everybody's doing them, whereas actually they're immoral, they're immodest, they're not proper, they're destructive to the fabric of society. There are many things destructive to mm-hmm. individuals that engage in them.
That's the whole point.
I think that we can work on our perception.
Okay.
And not be affected the way we are. Not I'll
give you an example.
One
of the issues that you're correct. The problem is the problem is like this. If we take to deal with this. You are correct. If you look at enough negative material, right, you will end up with a different problem, which is unfortunately what I deal with. Sometimes we have to deal with often, is that the person will have no ability, will have no sexual drive at all. So you're correct. Right? The problem is that then you have how do you build relationships with people? Right, so I'm saying it was a different problem, but I'm not. That's not typical. Unfortunately, it is all too typical, right? In what we have to deal with when we're dealing with intimacy, right? There's a whole field now of just creating intimacy. I'm not talking about the sexual. I'm not talking about the lingerie types of issues. I'm talking about between the rabbis and the sex therapists just trying to figure out what are we going to do with the people that don't have the normal drive, right? And not they don't have the normal drive because God didn't give it to them. They have the normal drive because it overdrove, and now there's nothing that's going to get them high. So there are negatives. I'll just show you that there are negatives to that type of exposure as well, which was not talked about till recently. Mm-hmm. A lot of the challenge that we have, I just have one couple right now. The problem is that they don't go to the rabbi, or they don't go to the sex therapist, depending on who they are, where they are in society. They didn't even realize that they have a problem. Right, which is not too uncommon. Right, when I marry couples, right, I talk about this straight, because it is a problem. At least they know that there's an address to go to if it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Right, my Rebbe told me. I remember in my class that I had, besides for learning the laws of family purity, but we have laws on set what we would call in modern terms sex education, so intimate education. So he spoke with me he told me straight up that, you know, after marriage, after the night of the marriage, generally it will take 4 to 5 nights, right, till you're going to be able to consummate the marriage. So you shouldn't get nervous. as he told me, he says if it doesn't work after 4 or 5 nights, so then you can call. Then I'll tell you what to do. Right? Now, funny enough, that in my in my learning and my studies and dealing with people, and the reason why I make sure that I talk about it with the guys is because later I learned that many people that didn't hear this, they get crazy. Because they literally get crazy. They don't understand what's wrong with them. If you hear before, that's not going to, okay, so then you don't worry about it because you know that that's normal. People just don't want to make sure that they're normal. Okay, but let's go back to the topic. So what do you deal with, you're asking, in society that has this this issue with the billboards, right? So you know what the answer is? The Aveira is not in seeing the billboard. The Aveira is looking at the billboard. That's correct. The Aveira is looking at the billboard.
Or that has meaning to you. That's the one I'm talking about.
You can't say... See, it's not when you say it has meaning. Of course, you want to say it doesn't have meaning, right? But it is human nature that in the society that you find yourself, you will be affected. I mean, even taking Vivian's point into play, that a person will define what is revealing based upon the society that they live in. Mm-hmm. Okay, even given that, society will always play, or the advertising will always play to the next line. Meaning television is written and designed to lower the bar of where it was yesterday. Because if it doesn't lower the bar or engage you, then you're not going to watch it.
Well, they say
the same way is that you...
Rights. It's First Amendment rights.
It's not First Amendment. That may be true, but that the First Amendment didn't change since 1950 to 2011. Right, when you watch there's a famous thing, right, where they have the television, it's cool to see, you watch the television series and the hemlines, right, are going, and what 8 o'clock to 11 o'clock television would show from 1950 till 2011.
Oh boy.
Right, and you'll see the difference.
Well,
now what it is it's always...
No, but just because you have the right under the Second Amendment to say something... doesn't mean you should.
No, I'm just saying that I'm just showing you that you see the way is you try. You always want to engage the person. I mean, it's true in the relationship in a positive way too, in the bedroom too. It's true in all areas, right? Just you have to use it toward sanctified living and not toward negative living. Okay, but the Aveira is in looking, right? Looking the second time. Whatever you want to use. There also is in thinking, right? How does the Talmud say? What should you do if you see or think about a negative image? See, I mean, obviously, look in the second time. You saw it already. Now, what should you do? People say, don't think about it. That's the typical answer when you see. Okay, there's only one problem with that. Your mind is not like eyes. Your eyes were given eyelids. Your ear, your nose, you can pinch, I guess. Your mouth, you can close. Your ears, you could insert the earlobe in it. There's only one thing that cannot be closed.
Your mind.
And that is your mind. You cannot extract a thought by not thinking about it. You cannot not think about it. The more you do not think about something, the more you will think about it. That is the way it's designed. Says the Talmud, it's just interesting. You see the Talmud, how do you not think about something? It doesn't say Yishina. You have to think about something else. And you think about the Gemara's examples, you think about Torah. Because it overtakes the mind. When you're thinking about Torah, the Gemara's words is, sin can only be found in a mind that is not thinking about Torah. Because you cannot think about, we are not that sophisticated. You can't do, you know what I mean, unless you're a genius. You usually can't think about two things at one time. So what you think about, that's what you think about. Right? So if you think about Torah, if you're studying Torah, right, or anything, it doesn't necessarily have to be Torah. Right, Torah has a certain sanctity to it, but the truth is, you have to be busy. Right, in general, that's why Judaism abhors vacuum. Right, it abhors a vacuum. As long as you're busy, where does it say sin is found? By people that are not working. The definition of work could be Gemara. The definition of work could be in the workplace. Right, I'm not talking about where you're bagging, you know, a thing. It has to be something that you're engaged. But when you're working and engaged in something, right, the Torah abhors laziness. right? Why does it abhor laziness? Not laziness, inherent, the problem of laziness, because it brings to sin. Mishkachas oven. There where you find an absence of work, it brings about sin. When people are industrious, they're busy. Right? Pharaoh knew that also, by the way. Right? Pharaoh said, don't give them straw. Why should you not give them straw? What does it have to do with the fact that they want to be redeemed from each slavery? You don't give them straw. It should be the opposite, by the way. If they want freedom, if you're going to give them straw, not give them straw, they're going to all want freedom. Right? Which is a question how you deal with society at large. But right? So what was Pharaoh thinking? I mean, obviously he was a very bright guy. Right? You know, he's a very bright guy. God doesn't usually mess with idiots. Right? He usually likes to get involved. What was Pharaoh thinking? Why? Because the answer is that the only reason they're thinking is because they're not busy. If they would be busier, they wouldn't be thinking about freedom. Right? Now, I'm not saying that's a positive. Okay, I'm just showing you the idea of the mind. Right? A person is supposed to be busy, and a person is supposed to be his mind engaged, so therefore he's not thinking about sin. Right? And that is the idea of moving on. You don't focus in Hasidic thought. Okay? By the way, that is the concept in Hasidic thought, why they spend very little time, right, on Yom Kippur. They spend this very little time on the Ashamnus, on the sinning, on where I've sinned this thing. Right? The idea is, right, that you don't put yourself where the sin is. Because when you put yourself where the sin is, you're again engaged in the sin. Mm-hmm. Right, and I'm not saying how we deal with it in the way that we run the service, but I just want you to take the concept, right? You want to take the concept that the idea is you want to be where you want to go, not where you were.
So on the supermarket checkout line, with all the magazines, we're not supposed to continue reading the headlines, if you, right?
That's why I have glasses.
Okay, I'm asking the level.
I'm serious. I'm not kidding.
What?
First of all, I take off my glasses. Mm-hmm. That's why I continue to wear. I'm always debating, should I get contacts? Because the glasses are not working. They simply will not work as well as they need to at this point. Right? Even though I have the thinnest lenses. Right? They just don't, they won't cut the thing. But nonetheless, it allows me to go like this. Right? And then everybody disappears when I take off my glasses. Except for Bill, I could see Bill. That's about, everybody disappears.
So it's called aura. Right. Okay, so I was asking your level, and now I've just learned my first level. So you really should look, you know.
I will tell you, it is a problem. I will tell you is that they did start to put some of the magazines, they started, then they stopped. In Lakewood, I'll give you an example, interestingly, in Lakewood, this was a big issue, the magazines. Was a big issue.
Because I like to know. So what they do is, even if I don't pick up the magazine, so that's what I'm saying.
I don't understand. Those magazines are called news.
No, I didn't say it was news. It's entertainment to me. So I'm on the line. I'm sitting there. You know.
This is an example, by the way, of what I'm talking about.
No, but the difference is I realize it's bad. I already know it's bad.
I go through that supermarket line. I am so not those magazines. I don't see them. I'm not interested.
Okay,
I know
so
it's
you're the challenge.
Ridiculousness and
Vivian, the challenge is
I
you're
don't
correct.
Have any desire
that is that you are 100% correct.
And that's the mindset I'm talking about.
You cannot. That is not as with
and
greatest.
And I think when you create this big book, it never occurred
the
to
greatest
me that those magazines
with the greatest respect.
Were evil and this.
That is true.
I'm not. It's like, why would I look at anything
but
so
we,
absolutely
but
disgusting and ridiculous? And
the answer, you're correct. You're correct. At a sanctified lifestyle or at a mature lifestyle, you're correct. But that we cannot. That is not realistic to expect the youth, right, to be at that maturity level for two reasons. One is that the hormones are not the same. That's a fact. That's a fact. And second of all is that is a maturity issue, right? Now, because the maturity is that the damage, right, you have to take from several factors, but you always have to be sensitive to the person you're counseling. The damage, we weigh things, right? We know teenagers take risks that is illogical, right? So they actually did a study, a very interesting study, that's not only just because they're teenagers. It seems to be that they're missing, assuming this study is true, right? Their brain completion is still completing
their
itself.
Frontal right, a voice,
right,
a team,
right, that they don't have that
right.
risk assessment.
Right, right.
Now, for example, right, normal people know that if you take this risk, the consequence is not worth the risk.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Exactly.
That's why, I'll be honest with you, is my boys, by the grace of God,
yeah.
Gershi in the end is not driving. Why? Right? Right? Part of the challenge that we have is that their risk aversion, right, you could just hear from the way they talk, right, I'm not saying that everybody, this is a proper practice, I'm just explaining, right, you ask, the risk of going at the higher speed, right, when you don't have the experience of driving on the Indy 500, right, is not logical, but nonetheless, you see, we were driving the other day, right, on Parkway Calabasas, and somebody caught literally an inch in front of me. And I don't drive at 5 miles an hour, right? The guy went like this. So I couldn't see. I was busy trying to deal with the road. So Gershi, I was trying to figure out, who was that? He says, oh, he was one of the teenagers from up the street. I mean, the guy literally went. There wasn't a room for a half a car. He somehow managed to get the car in between me, then the next person, then the next person. But the thing was, what was he risking for? He wasn't going anywhere. He was going to the same red light 5 seconds later that I was going to. So the meaning is that there's a no risk aversion. So you have to be sensitive to the reality of the constituency that you're dealing with, right? And not take the level that you and I would assess at, you know, at the risks. You're certainly correct in saying that it is illogical what people are being turned on by, right? It's disgusting. That is true in terms of our conversation and the approach that we could take. But when you're dealing with the reality of the students, right, at their level, right, you have to put it in terms that they're going to be able to relate with and that society is actually going to adopt, right? I will tell you is that one person, they have attached, now, I'm not saying this is the way that I would have dealt with it. I felt that they should have approached the company and dealt with the whoever owns that billboard. But in one of the city's shuls in the city, they have a billboard attached to the wall that's attached to the shul, but it's not their wall. It belongs to the store next door. Okay? So they had a billboard for one of these places.
No.
Right? It was I could not believe it. I mean, of all places, they had to put it. Right? So it was there. So I see somebody took a spray can. I don't know if it was a Jew. I don't know if it was a guy. I have no idea who it is. Person took a spray can and spray painted some of the billboard. Right? Right? And the truth is that if we had a society that abhors these issues, it would not, there would not be, those billboards would not be there. Right? I say that the number reason when I speak on rape issues, usually every two or three, we have a focused lecture just on this topic. Right, so we've spoken about this in the past, by the Parsha of Sota. The reason why rape is so occurrent in society here in America is because we don't take a strong enough stand.
Thanks.
If society would take a strong stand against it, it would not be so commonplace. So that which you accept by non-action or by inaction, right, is what becomes commonplace. Anti-Semitism is the same thing, by the way. Anti-Semitism, people push the envelope to what society, right, in the American, I'm not talking about if you're in Palestinian territories itself, because that's something else. I'm talking about in free society, wherever the line is created, that is the line that they will play with. Right, and that's why you see Norway is finished. Right? Forget about Norway. They're hopeless. Right. Any of the countries, and even the United States, if we're not going to admit where our line is, and we're not willing to say that, no, those two of those students were Muslim, and printed in the paper, right? I'm not saying identify the person, that's a separate issue, I'm not discussing that. If you don't admit that you have a problem, you will never find a solution, right? But the second fear that I have is you don't create the line, right? When you study Nazi Germany, that's what Hitler, the genius of Hitler and his advisors, was that is exactly what they did. I mean, Hitler was a maniac, but he was a genius, right? And together with his team, right, you will see the progression of how they pushed the envelope and the very, very strategic moves that they made, right, all in their own words. You could see how they did this and how they kept stretching the line and see what would be the reaction of the Western world, which was the great genius of Chamberlain, right? Right, in his La La Land that he lived in, right? But really, is that was the West, but also inside of Germany itself, right? Germany didn't move overnight. Germany didn't become Nazi mm-hmm. Germany overnight. It was a very calculated plan how he did that, how he got rid of the enemy, how he got rid of even the German enemy, right, inside, and slowly stretched the line. So wherever you create your line, no, we're putting our foot down, that really is where they have to push and pull. And as long as that keeps stretching, right, then you have to fear, because then you're still on the downslide.
I just want to make one comment, because you just mentioned that there's a study that teenagers have a problem with assessing risk. I don't really buy that. I mean, I remember when I was a teenager, I still remember, things I used to do that, looking back on, I said, geez, I was really a lunatic. But the point is, everything I did and all my friends did, especially in cars, it wasn't that we didn't know the risk, is that the risk didn't apply to us. We were so professional and so good at driving that was for the other people.
Yeah, that's more
we
right.
could do that.
I think that this is
and that's true that even today. I mean, I deal a lot of people say who smoke. You talk to them. It's not going to happen to me. I can smoke all I want. It's the other guy that's going to get cancer and die, not me.
No, there's an invincibility factor.
Right.
No, there is an invincibility factor.
Right.
I am invincible.
And teenagers have no understanding of death.
I think all of us have to live like that to a certain extent, because if every minute you think you're going to die, then you can't live.
Yeah.
You have to live with a certain amount of thinking that you're going to live.
I was even in a car.
It's not, don't be afraid that you're going to die. It's right. Watch out what you do to somebody else.
Right.
Well, you don't even think of that.
How are you going to fix somebody
but
that you create there?
What I'm saying is, again, I'm only talking from a personal experience. I was even after I was once in an accident where I went through the windshield, okay, almost died. You think I didn't stop driving fast? I mean, I wasn't the driver. We were in a car. We had a friend. It was a Friday night or Saturday night. And one of our friends at the time, I was a freshman in college, and one of our friends didn't go to college. He was in the Army, because if you didn't go to college, you were drafted. And he was stationed, we live in Philadelphia, he was stationed at a Nike base. I don't know if everyone knows what that was, but that was an anti-missile type of thing back in the late 50s, early 60s. And he had to get back to base. So one of our friends, his father had just bought a brand new Chevy, okay? I don't know why he let his son drive, because his son was blind at night. My mother said, don't ever drive with this guy because he can't see at night. But I didn't care. We didn't care. We all jumped in the car and we drive him to the Nike base in New Jersey. We're riding down a farm road, no lights. And all of a sudden someone said, how fast can this car go? Oh, I don't know. So we rolled up the windows. And we're going down this road. This car was going, I don't know, 80, 90 miles an hour on a road. There were no lights, no nothing. All of a sudden, we come, and there is a sign saying the road goes this way. Okay? Well, there's no way we could have made negotiate that turn. Hit a ditch, car turned over, burst into flame. Everyone's thrown out of the car. I went through the windshield. I tell this story because after that, you think I cared? As soon as I got a car, I was driving 100 miles an hour, whatever. There's a road in Philadelphia called the Benjamin Franklin Parkway.
I don't know how you got a car.
Why did you do that?
I can't get
my car. I got a car.
I can't get my car past 80.
I got it from insurance money. And one of the first things I did...
It doesn't go.
Just to see how fast it could go.
Right. Okay. I just have to close with one. I apologize. I'm sorry. one more interpretation. One more interpretation, which unfortunately we didn't get to really discuss and explore, but it's really important, and that's the Ramban's explanation. The Ramban expresses a concept which I think we all can relate with, and that is called moderation. The Ramban expresses that the idea of leading a sanctified life is leading a life of moderation, which he explains means kadesh atzmecha bimutalach, which means sanctify yourself by that which is permitted to you. Just because you can does not mean you should. And he says, just because if you buy kosher wine, then you should be able to get drunk every night. Right? It's kosher. The answer says the Ramban, that's not what God has in mind. Mm-hmm. Just because the meat is kosher doesn't mean you should dine on fine meat every single night. Right? Is you could lead a gluttonous, glut kosher life. Says the Ramban, that's not what God's design is. So God had to take, he gave you 612 mitzvot. But each of those you could live in, when you deal with them with the permitted things, you could live in excess, a life of excess. You're allowed to marry more than one wife. So you could always be engaged, as he talks about. You could always be engaged in permitted sexuality. Says the Ramban, that's not what God has in mind. So he gave one mitzvah that trims fashions all of the mitzvos. Is what's the goal? The goal is to lead a life of sanctity. You're to use the world that God gave you, use and not abuse, even in the design of what the goal is, to design you toward the goal, says the Ramban. This is the mitzvah that fashions all others and tells you, lead a life of sanctity. The expression that he uses, a naval b'rishus haTorah, a degenerate with the permission of the Torah. If you abuse the gifts of God's world, you'll be a degenerate. It'll be, did I do an Aveira? I didn't do an Aveira. It's like the person that does every single, you know, cheat, you know, and he manages to get away from the law. They bring him to court, and he finds, you know, the ticket wasn't this way, this wasn't, you know, you always, you know, what's his name? O.J. Simpson. Right? He wasn't guilty. He wasn't guilty on... of course,
the glove didn't fit.
Right, the glove didn't fit. He was guilty. He was only guilty civilly. You know? Right, he was only guilty civilly, not criminally. Right, so he was a nobler. He was a degenerate with the permission of the Torah. I mean, he found a way out of the technical legal issues, but that's a novel Rishus HaTorah. Says the Ramban, a life of moderation. Use God's world. Right, you're supposed to enjoy God's world. But you're supposed to enjoy it, to live a life of sanctity, says the Ramban, and not a life of self-indulgence. That would be the three concepts of us of this week's introduction, Parsha.
That is indulgence, but that is, I'm thinking, impossible. It's so hard.
What is hard?
Well, perhaps one day you could talk about... I've always been curious about your own background. You were born in, you weren't raised in a...
The family was not religious when I grew
so
up.
So I'm really curious how you got to where you are and the steps, because surrounded by everything, I find it, I choose the other way. And I don't mean in totally an immoral way, but it all, like, do I come to the class today or do I sleep in? Do I come to the class or go out late last night? You know what I'm saying? We're talking about all the decisions about Kedusha, not just about doing, you know, not just about going to one of those places. We're talking...
So there honestly is dealing with... then I do think that Covey's book, I mean, Mesillas Yesharim will also do it, but... But in Covey's book, a lot of these ideas of, in seeing Covey's book, in the big one he does it too, but in seeing Covey's book particularly, he gives very good of examples, but you have to work. I mean, that's a workshop question. It's not about wanting to. I want you to know it's not about wanting to, because you want, okay, you have no question that you want.
Are you saying I want to lead a life of sanctity?
Yes, there's no question that you want to. It's that you have not created the parameters that force you to fulfill that which you want to do.
I think I only want to about 50 to 75%.
I don't believe that's true. No.
Okay.
Want, because you have the inspiration. When you want something, the real definition of what you want is based upon an ideology when you're in the right mood and frame of mind. The goal then is to translate that into when you're no longer in the mood and you're lazy, or you're no longer in the mood and depression sets in. The goal is, we never make decisions when we're depressed. That's Aleph Beis. Okay, you never make decisions when you're depressed. Right? You have to make action you have when you're intellectually balanced. Then you write it down. Right? You set your goals clearly. You write it down. And then you create a plan of how, when you're not in the mood, you're not in the mode, that you are forced to action based upon that ideal plan. right? And that's the only way you can do anything in life.
Right.
Because you're not going to constantly be inspired. You should not feel that anybody could be inspired enough to go. It's like going, right? It's always a battle. All of us, it's a battle of mind over mattress. That was from Covey. I can't take credit for that line.
Not even the mattress. He says,
mind over mattress. Or, I have a great problem, right? You see it even in my work. You deal with it when you deal with me. But when you have 339 emails, okay? Right? So, really what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to take the top three important emails and deal with them first in the day and then everything second. But unfortunately, and I'm guilty, this is a problem that I have, I try to get rid of those that take 1 second, those that take 3 seconds, those that take 10 seconds, but it is not, and I'm guilty, I still have not covered this, but seeing 339 emails, right, is mind-boggling. And I'm talking, that's not talking about from shopping emails, because those, I'm not subscribed to those.
You have to follow Yisro.
Right?
Oh, that's good.
Very good. You right?
That's good.
Okay. Very, very good. I think that that's where you need to focus. I don't think you have a question of your conviction. You're trying to get your conviction to override all obstacles. I don't think that's correct. I think you need to set yourself up a system by which you're forced. The force of the water is going to push you in that direction. I mean, that's the idea of having a partner. Right? Having a partner. You have somebody, he calls you at 7 o'clock in the morning, get up. I don't want to get up today. It doesn't matter whether you want, right? You're getting up today, right? I mean, that's how certain motivational factors, I mean, the army, right? Properly used. A good teacher, we'll end here. A good teacher always has the threat of punishment, but the master teacher never punishes.
Yeah.
Never punishes. The minute you have to punish already, you've lost it. It's the concept that you hold over, right? The master teacher, my greatest teacher in 8th grade, who's the only teacher that had absolute control, right? Mrs. Rakowski, she should live and be well. Never, you didn't sneeze in that class if she didn't give you permission.
No, I'm sorry. Okay? Like
whereas the other teachers, we got 55 zeros in a row, we got punishments, we had to write assignments, right? The kids were dancing off the roof. This lady never gave a zero, never gave a punishment. It was self-understood. Everybody scored a 96 or above on the state test. There was no such thing. In her class, you didn't dream. I have no idea what she did. She never punished. She never raised a voice. Nothing. She gave over such an aura that you were going to die if you did anything. Even though she never said nothing.
It wasn't that she was positive. Didn't she positively?
No, it wasn't positive feedback. It was self-understood that you would, right, you would be dead if you did. So, even though she never gave a zero, never yelled. She never raised a voice. Never. Right, but there was a certain aura of punishment, but never punishment. That's a master teacher. Master teacher gives over an aura, but we all learned. I mean, we all sat there, worked. The second she left the classroom, the next teacher came in, absolute pandemonium.
Thank you very, very much.
Yes,
that was really special.
Thank you.